businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 171 of the Killing It Podcast. This is Carl. I'm joined today by Dave and Ryan, as always, and we have a very interesting show for you today. But first,
we're all nice and warmed up, but I'm going to start us off with a silly, fun one, gents. What sport would be the funniest to add a mandatory amount of alcohol to?
Well, see, I will start by saying nothing that has actual hardcore physical contact, like football with alcohol would be, American football with alcohol would be a terrifying just recipe for compound fractures. That would not be cool.
They call that
but
rugby.
I can vouch for, I know, I can vouch for with firsthand experience the bottomless amounts of humor that ensue when you mix golf and alcohol. So it's not good sports, but it's really entertaining.
I think golf and alcohol already are a sport. Like, that's already how you
play.
Yeah,
and same thing with hockey. You know, it's the only sport, I think, in the Olympics where the winning team has to buy the losing team the first drink. So, but I like any sport where I can have a beer in one hand and whatever in the other hand, whether that's hockey or croquet or whatever. But if I were going to add alcohol to a sport, it would probably have to be the axe throwing that is becoming so popular.
Yeah, I think that already comes, and the same as like cornhole. Those already have, like, that's already.
Well, cornhole is another one where you can have a beer in one hand and then the thing in the other hand.
So I'm not sure on this one, and I think my answer would probably be soccer. And I will say from a general perspective, particularly, and I know this is blasphemous for some, like, I can find big international meets really boring because there's a lot of no scoring and a lot of running around doing very little. It's true, because in baseball there at least is like it's intentional pauses. With soccer, it's supposed to be going on. There's supposed to be a timed bit, but then they're just running doing nothing, as opposed to baseball where we know we're doing nothing. And so I could say, like, if I added alcohol to soccer, I'm reasonably confident that would be funny.
Well, and see, there's, you're making a distinction. Alcohol for the fans or alcohol for the participants? Because I'm thinking if you were going to add it, it would need to be on any of the precision concentration sports. Like, I'm thinking if you added it to tennis, like every time you switch sides, you got to drink a beer. That would get super entertaining really fast. High level table tennis, right?
Or chess.
Imagine that kind of spinning with a little bit too much to drink. That'd be excellent. Now that's a whole deep topic, Dave. We didn't even.
It's a whole other podcast. Are you still relying on a frustrating patchwork of legacy solutions? Modernize your cybersecurity and data protection with Acronis CyberProtect Cloud. It's a single solution that combines backup, anti-malware, and endpoint protection management. As an MSP, you can easily improve client security posture, eliminate complexity, and generate more recurring revenue. Learn more about Acronis CyberProtect Cloud at acronis.com.
So we have a very odd first topic today, and I have to explain it a bit, but we've all talked about deep fakes, where basically people are able to create videos and pretend to be that person. Well, now people are doing deep fakes for job interviews, in particular for tech jobs. And the weirdest part of this is that they're not actually trying to get the job. They're fishing for information from the interviewers, from the job process, getting into the websites. It's layers and layers of what the hell is next. It's one of the oddest things. I was not aware that people were faking job interviews with the technology of basically having a team of people behind them giving them the correct answers to live interview questions. But now there's this, where people actually pretend to be a non-existent job applicant, have a fake resume, have the people behind them and are then sort of digging into the interviewer's technology while the interview is going on. It's like, yeah.
What? Or get hired. Like an end result of this, I read the FBI warning, or literally go all the way is get hired and then get inside the organization as a remote
employee. Right, as a remote employee. So now you've got to log on and credentials and the whole deal. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
It's brilliant. Like let's call it. It is. Come on. We have to acknowledge and admire our adversaries' intelligence. I think it's to our own detriment to not take these guys seriously and laugh and talk about it. It's like, oh no, they're freaking smart. That's brilliant. What a great exploit. What an incredible, fascinating way to get in there. Because I covered this on Business of Tech, and my advice there, what I gave was, is your hiring process include actual verification that this is a real person? And know that they may actually be trying to use stolen credentials to get through your process. Is your process ready for that? Because I think most are not.
See, I think that is the excellent point here. In a world where we are trying to grow and it is harder than ever to find and hire a new employee, there's been a ton of conversation around that in the world. But then also we mix that with a hybrid or remote working world where we advocate for expanding the footprint of your organization. That is a set of circumstances begging for exploitation, and it could be, as in this situation, a creative way to get credentials and sign in and just pillage your network for all of its deepest secrets. Or it could be, I'm 13 and I'm bored and I really don't have anything to do this summer, so I deepfaked myself into a grown-up and I did the Tom Hanks Big, but I had Google it at my disposal, so I sounded at least as smart as the average level one tech, and I got a job, and you didn't realize that. I would say your advice is spot on, Dave. The average MSP or solution provider is so woefully bad at recruiting that it is highly surprising that they have not already been exploited in this process. Like, we don't pay for background checks, we don't pay for professional review of references, we don't actually spend the time with these people that we need. Most people are just like, well, I hire somebody once every 3 or 4 years and I'm bad at it. Do you want to work for me? You do? Okay, fine, right. You start on Monday. That's not enough.
Well, and if it's a totally online thing, one of the things that occurs to me is that maybe this is your next $1 million job opportunity, is to create a service that filters out job applicants so that you provide the video channel, you provide credentials to prove this is a real human being who exists in the real world and they have a real address and a pulse and stuff like that. But I think it's very sad because, yes, these people are very, very smart, but holy smokes, imagine how much good they could do for the world if they used their knowledge for good things instead of evil things. I don't know, just me.
Well, to a certain degree, we have to remember that we have to create situations at time where they are economically incentivized to do that. One of the reasons why we have as many cyber criminals coming from Russia or China is that they have systems that are economically motivating them to take advantage. That is the best set of jobs and governmental cover that allows it, that is more than willing to admit.
We also have massive fraud. One of the things that's amazing about all this is how fast they come up with this stuff, right? They introduced the incentives a few years ago because of COVID, and all the guys in prison decided, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to apply for 1,000 unemployment checks, have them sent to my friends and cousins and relatives and former spouses. And we literally in California, we can't even calculate how many billions of dollars have been lost to unemployment fraud just because of that. And it's all these people they're not in Russia. They're in California prisons.
Well, but again, speaking of an economic incentive to do something other than what you are already doing during the day, I think that one qualifies. I think this is a great time, though, to stop and readdress just the continuous evolution of the cybersecurity game. I think if any of us believe for a moment that, like, I got this. We paid attention to it real hard a couple of years ago. We spent some money. We bought some services. We subscribed to one or two things that I think are still active. We've got this handled. No, you don't. Because in any adversarial economy, there has to be continuous innovation. Innovation on the side of the defenders in cybersecurity, that's what we all do for a living. We're trying to find new ways to defend against this plethora of attack vectors and techniques. Well, the other guys have to be innovative as well. And if there's a new technology out there, they're going to use it to attack you. It's why cybersecurity is the most evergreen business service you will ever provide.
Well, let's put a pin in cybersecurity because we will revisit that. And I'm going to move us into topic number two. So I want to address as we're going to tackle something that has political implications. We're going to talk about the business implications. Of course, the Supreme Court in the United States has overturned the Roe versus Wade ruling and has removed that federal protection for abortion, allowing a number of states to move forward with trigger laws. So there were 13 states with trigger laws, including Texas's, which includes the ability for citizens to sue providers individually. Additionally, there's a collection of other states, and it may be as many as 26 states that end up fully banning abortion within their states or having severe restrictions. The context then, in a technology standpoint, is the discussion around data privacy. We're linking to an article from The Verge that dives into some of this, but the context here is we have gone from a state where one set of conditions was allowed and legal, and then have a dramatically different set of conditions after that, and the implications on information around this space. And I will say this is a scary area for many people who had not thought of the downsides of certain sets of data, which now can be exploited. One example, period trackers. So if a woman is tracking her period, that data is logged as healthcare data, then you have a period of time where perhaps that period is no longer being tracked. Then it appears again, and if there is no baby at the end of that sign, that could be used as evidence that there was an abortion. Gents, looking at this through the lens of data privacy and what's going on in a data protection world, what's your kind of takeaway and thinking on the implications for MSPs, IT services companies here?
Well, it would be nice to think that a privacy law would do the trick, but clearly, if you're downloading an app and serving up your data through China and then through Google and government agencies and whatnot, then you've given up your right to HIPAA protection for this, even though it's a health matter. So I don't know that another privacy law is going to do us much good, although I suspect privacy laws working their way through the system will get amended. I'm not sure it's going to do them any good.
I think data ownership laws would probably be particularly as they relate to health. So healthcare is a great example. So I was doing my own research on this to try and make sure I was caught up, and I had not quite fully realized the implication under HIPAA that patients don't own their data, right? In fact, the doctors and the healthcare systems own their data. As I think through that as a technologist, that does make some sense. I understand it, but perhaps we want to start defining kinds of data that individuals own versus companies own, and what a privacy law defines on that, because that's how warrants get used. If you're, the reason that this is potentially now open as an exposure is not necessarily the nature of the data, but the fact that it is owned by a company rather than the person. So if an investigator wants to determine it, they can issue a warrant to the company that owns the data, who then was not necessarily motivated the same way to protect it as an individual might. And I think for me, the framing was I'm not necessarily confident it's a quote-unquote data privacy law. It's more specific details of what information are personal and owned by the person, not owned by the collector.
Well, and see, I had two main reactions to this from the business and data perspective. Number one is that it is high time that individuals take this seriously as a culture, as an industry, from both sides, the people asking for and gathering information, as well as the people who are giving up information. There is a profound casual approach to the way that we deal with our own personal information. A business will say, click here and to agree with our terms of use, and we'll just collect literally everything about you, even if our business model is only built on the premise of having three or four pieces of data. We're going to legally ask for, and you're going to click to sign, for allowing me to track literally hundreds of different pieces of information. Do you need that to run your business? No, but I might. And at some point in the future, wouldn't it be interesting to go back and mine it and see if I could unlock further business value? That's outrageously irresponsible, and it's something that we need to start taking seriously. On the user's side, we tend to look at things and go, I can get a free emoji. Cool. I'll tell you my birth date and my mom's maiden name. I'll give away all kinds of information because that means I can watch this video without ads or whatever. It is no longer that kind of a world. You live in a world where the data that you give up can and will be used against you in a court of law. And that is something that makes everybody stop and think more carefully, which led to my second thought about this. There are a tremendous number of business models that are going to be almost instantly disrupted by new government regulation. And it doesn't matter what that regulation is. You described the scenario perfectly, Dave. We lived in a set of conditions where this information was not fraught with legal peril. It was perfectly valid to ask for. It was something that people were willing and comfortable sharing. And then the government came in and said, by the way, here's a new law. And it changed those conditions markedly overnight. All of those businesses that are doing that kind of service, 10 days ago, their stock price was probably pretty healthy. 10 days from now, when people wake up and go, oh, shit, that's actually really material to their results, I don't think those companies are going to continue as a going concern because their basic foundation of business principle has been altered. If you think that's unique to this situation, think about when HIPAA was introduced back in the good old days of Graham Leach Bliley, back in any of these things. Yesterday, this data was fine. I'll give it to you. It's cool. Tomorrow, oh crap, the government came calling and now it's radically different. The government is going to cause some unintended disruption that will literally put chunks of industries out of business.
I keep hearing all of this discussion about compliance being the new space, but I actually think the underlooked opportunity around this is, and I don't have a good name for it, but I use data management and data management services, meaning the idea not of, you know, hey, we're just going to help protect your data and make sure it doesn't get blown up in a disaster, but that we will look at your data and work with you and make sure you are intentionally collecting only what you need to collect and not more than that to reduce your risk. And I think that's a very deliberate set of choices that consultants and IT providers and can deliver as a service. And it's in my pile of, and super valuable, right? And so you can charge real money for that. But more importantly, like, it's hard. And it's going to be only a small subset of people that are able to
There's also ways that the companies who collect the data can store it and use it and have policies around that. One of the early case studies on using metadata was Target, right? Basically figuring out that women were pregnant before the women knew they were pregnant and sending them advertising and so forth, and then figured out that's just a little over the creepy line, and so they stopped doing that. But that doesn't mean they stopped collecting the data. They just stopped using it in specific ways. And so when we look at larger corporations, you can see corporations thinking, maybe what we'll do is have a policy of only storing data in a certain way so it can't be used for this and that, and only reporting it in certain ways. There's a long history in the health research field of not ever disclosing data in a way that it can be identified to a group smaller than 10 within a certain geographic area, right? So there's some groundwork for how to proceed, but it's a different world. I will say, last word on this, Ryan, you're full of shit, that we have been warned about giving up our data in exchange for privacy for 15 years, and so far, not one person on Earth has paid attention to it.
No, see, that's exactly what we're saying. We've all been really cavalier. Oh, it's fine. It's totally fine. You don't live in that world anymore. It ain't fine anymore. Speaking of, we're going to jump over into our third topic and go back to the world of cybersecurity, this time in the context of the ongoing G7 meetings that are happening, at which senior political officials are coming to violent agreement on the fact that A, cybersecurity might be important, welcome to the party, and B, that the nations in the G7 ought to actually, I don't know, have a policy. Now, the way that they're doing it, we're linking to a very interesting article here that talks about a new proposal for the G7 nations pooling together foreign aid money that will be used for four different purposes. There's 4,000 reasons you could use foreign aid, but they've agreed on four, and to get them to agree on those four are some really big strides forward. One of the four is on cybersecurity. Now, the really interesting link to this is it's funding for emerging or developing nations, those that are smaller, that are economically challenged, etc. We're going to give them money, but we're going to do it in a way that it has hooks for implications around how they deal, A, with development of technology, and B, with the way they deploy their government systems and resources so that they can ensure cybersecurity. I think this is a very interesting, if not hellaciously complicated, approach, but what do you guys think? Does it have legs?
Well, the warning was what I dug into, because I was really, I wondered what the, because the headline is that there's state official warns of peril to the goals. And as I dug into the article, what was striking to me was that the peril they were focusing on was that if you don't include input from the developing nations into the standards, you're actually closing off a lot of potential opportunity and needs from those. And I'm struck by the parallels to, funny what happens when one group of people does not include the others in thinking about the outcomes of this. I can see history rhyming again on this. Which set of rights around, in other areas do we want to focus on? I'm clearly very pro defining this. I'm pro collaboration, but I also want to make sure that we're very deliberate and inclusive and think of these downsides. Like, we need to be careful about making sure to include all the parties, all of the necessary stakeholders. And it's not just Western G7 nations. It can be large. It needs to be larger than that if this is going to be a technology we're relying on, particularly because we've had discussions around things like the SplinterNet problem, where we don't necessarily want whole sections of the internet carving themselves off, where we can't do business, where the rules of the road aren't applied. There's so much downside here.
Well, and I was going to mention the SplinterNet, because clearly what's going on, it's actually going on right now around the world, is China is offering internet connectivity and services to countries who have felt a little bit alienated by the West, or have felt like the West has spent, 100 or 200 years taking advantage of them. And, now your good friends in China are going to show you an alternative internet, which is, free of all that capitalist bullshit, and away we go. It's also the case that we are pushing a group of nations in the United States version of the contract for the web. So this is the contract for our part of the web. Now, whether you split it into two, or include the Russians and split it into three, or now include developing nations and split it into four, we could have some very different connections of the so-called internet just in a few years, because all you got to do is replace a few routers and you're done.
Well, and we did it organically. It happened right here in this conversation, as well as 10 minutes ago in our first segment, where we said cybersecurity, there might be issues, .. You wonder why people are motivated to do this. It has a lot to do with economic conditions, .. Russia, China, right? Like, that connection was something that organically came up in this conversation. And it is precisely the feedback that these diplomats are actually expressing that they're receiving from China and Russia, right? The G7 gets together, everybody slaps everybody on the back. They go to Austria in the summertime, which I can't highly recommend enough. That's fantastic. And they all agree cybersecurity is a big deal. We are the good guys. We should write the rules. And instantly, the emissaries from Russia and China that are not invited to these meetings, they write back and say, whoa, you don't get to define the rules for us. We're going to do it differently. Now, whether you read into that any malintent, or if you just read into it exactly what you were describing, Carl, of if you don't invite me to where the rules are made, why would you expect me to obey the rules? In either case, whether it's aggressive or benign, those two nations are not going to feel cozy with this arrangement. And it is, my takeaway is, it's a noble approach. It's a great idea. I am thrilled that even the great big nation economies that are run by old, outdated people who do not know how to spell cybersecurity, they believe it's one of the four topics that we can all agree on that we need to address in the developing world. That's a fantastic idea. But if they think that they're just going to be able to, like, shake hands, take a press photo, and it's going to be accepted by the world, no, this will be the first volley in an escalation where you're going to get back something even more confrontational from those who don't agree.
Let me say, I am heartened by the fact that there's, as you said, there's distinct investments of time and energy. I mean, the fact that the State Department has dedicated resources for cybersecurity and for cyber relations, the fact that these are coming up in diplomatic meetings, this does mean that there is a mechanism of people spending considerable time and effort thinking about these issues, determining how they're going to address it, and doing something about it. I just want to make sure that they, you know, the added input is the don't leave out all of the necessary players and all of the downside, because it has generally been the trend that anything on technology, we're not spending enough time thinking about the downside and bad consequences of things. We tend to only focus on the good outcomes.
I was going to say, I don't think anybody listens to this podcast hoping that they get some tips on negotiating international agreements. But on the diplomacy side, when you sit down and you say, I want to invite an extra, whatever, 50 countries to sit down at the table, you know that you might have to give up something, but you also gain a tremendous amount. Even if they don't change anything substantive, you gain a huge amount by having those extra voices at the table. And I think fundamentally, that's something the West can do that China will not.
And by the way, I want to bring this way down because I want to make sure that the average MSP who's listening, or IT services provider who's listening to this, is not going, oh, well, this is so big and I don't think about it. The bit that I want you to focus on is, look, this is yet another set of kind of regulations that are out there that someone is working on, that you need to have a process built into your business of collecting, reviewing, and inserting into the process. Yes, this may not happen for a while, but at some point you're going to need a way of managing, ingesting, and doing something with this, because it will impact some portion of the way you deliver services, particularly because security is part of everything. So, no, even if you're just starting to build out that practice area or that methodology now, no, you're going to have to spend some time working on that.
Well, and I will admit, I originally misread the lead to the article, and it says there's, you know, the G7, they're going to agree on some new approach to cybersecurity, and they're going to use actual pools of money and put conditions on how it is distributed, and the number is $200 billion. And I thought, Well, that might actually start to cover the need. If they put $200 billion into cybersecurity, you might actually make a dent in this thing. And then I read on and I realized, oh, well, that's only one of the priorities and it's not going to get a tiny fraction. My advice to local providers, the government's never going to, they're going to create the need for your services and compliance with their regulations. They are never going to solve this problem, and your customers are going to find more and more reasons to just throw up their hands and go, it's too hard. I can't do this. I can't do digital commerce.
Sadly, that will do it for episode 171 of the Killing It.
Killing It
podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.